The soft overcomes the hard, the slow overcomes the fast. It's from the Tao Te Ching, chapter 36. My name is Swan, and I'm blowing you kisses from the basement of the Velo Bike Shop, and you are listening to Ink and Worm, all things reading and writing. Today's show is going to be wonderful and also a little interesting. I have a wonderful guest whom I will introduce later. However, she is at an event right now, and so we're going to call her a few minutes into the show. So I'm doing an experiment, and you'll have to let me know your thoughts, if you hate it, if you love it, if you want more of it. We could probably accommodate that. We're going to do a writing exercise, so if you are available to sit down and write for a few minutes with me, grab a pen and some paper. If you're driving, please don't try and write with me, because that might be dangerous, and I don't want to be responsible for anything happening to you. But if you're looking for pen and paper, awesome. If you found it, great. I'm going to keep chatting for a minute to just give anyone who is listening live a moment to find one. So I will mention that my guest today is Geeta Dayal, and she writes about electronic music a lot, among other things. And so I am going to encourage you to respond to a writing prompt about the music that shaped you. So this is a quick free write. Write whatever comes to your mind, pen to the page as fast as you can. Don't stop and think. Don't allow that editor to creep in. It's almost like vomiting with writing. You're just like going, running with it. And if for some reason you don't want to write about the music that shaped you, you don't have to. You can write against the prompt and maybe just do a timed free write of something that is your choice. And anything is encouraged. So grab your pen and paper. If you still don't have one, see if you can find one. If you are driving, maybe utilize that voice to text thing and take some notes as you contemplate the music that has shaped you. And we will put on some nice, calm music while this is happening, and I will be writing with you. So this is really fun, exciting new thing. My writing might be a little bit more scattered because I'll be checking in on technology and music and all that jazz, but it should be fun. So writing, if you're ready to write with me, writing about the music that shaped you. if you were riding with me, go ahead and finish up what you're currently thinking, writing, working on. And part of writing is having the vulnerability to read it to someone. So I would perhaps tell someone, you know, I just did this free write. I'd love to share it with you. I don't really need any feedback. I just wanted someone to hear it. So I was going to do that, but it seems like our guest just let me know that she is ready. And so let's see if we can get a hold of her and get started with a wonderful conversation.
Hello?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Hi. Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, wonderful. All the technology worked in our favor. And so anyone listening in, this is Geeta. Is it Dayal?
Dayal. Geeta Dayal. Yeah.
Perfect. Let me turn that music off. I did a little free write about the music that shaped me. For anyone listening in, they could write about it. You are a San Francisco-based journalist and critic, often covering a variety of topics, including music, film, art, culture, design, science, and technology. You hold two undergraduates from MIT and a master's degree from Columbia, and you've written articles published in Slate, Wired, the Boston Globe, and the New York Times, Rolling Stones, and a bunch of other publishing things online and in print. You also do frequent guest speaking, and you've been an instructor and author of Another Green World about Brian Eno, published in 2009. Pretty extensive. You've been busy.
Wow, yeah. Thanks for that introduction.
My pleasure. So I would love to kind of open it up and just... I just read your book about Brian Eno and found it really wonderful. I love the approach that you took. And it seems like a theme in your writing that you don't want to add... you don't want to repeat what other people have said. You want to add something new to the conversation. So I'd love for you to talk about how that kind of became such a strong influence for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've always wanted to dig a little bit deeper and find something new to say. Just because also, like, these days online, I feel like so many blogs and websites are just literally repeating each other. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes like this giant echo chamber where you'll see it on Twitter. It's like a zillion people all talking about the same thing, and each story seems almost the same. And so, you know, I've really tried to counteract that a lot, to try to add new and interesting and obscure things, mm-hmm. and just kind of slip them in. And so that's always been my guiding principle, in a way, to try to do something that's new. It might be a little bit obscure. It might be, a little more esoteric.
Yeah.
But I'm happy about that because at least it's adding something new. It's trying to write more about the fringes. So it's like, even if I'm writing about somebody like Brian Eno, who's a pretty well-known figure, mm-hmm. I'm trying to write about him in a different way, so using kind of a different angle.
Well, and I wonder, I'm curious about the research process, because it seems like for that book, I mean, you listened to that soundtrack at least 100 times fast and slow, and I'm sure you listened to all of his other music just as much. How much research goes into... or maybe let's specify it to that book. How much time would you say was devoted to research?
An enormous amount of time. And even things that look like they don't have, like, tons of research are actually, like, every sentence is informed by, you know, like, a lifetime of thinking and listening very hard about music. So it's like everything that I try to write, it's like I'm coming at it from... thinking very hard about it. Mm-hmm. And so with something like the Eno book, it took 2 straight years to write and research. And I literally had, I was like literally knee deep in printouts, like literally knee deep in printouts. I had just thousands of pages on my floor of like old interviews with Eno, like all kinds of stuff, all kinds of rare zines, weird stuff that I would dig up. And so, you know, I was really, really like researching everything I possibly could.
Well, that I feel like that potency came into the writing because you had to compress. I think you had to compress so much that the editing process must have been excruciating of deciding what to include and what not to include.
Yeah, I have like 10 different versions of that Eno book. And actually, for Patreon, one of the things that I'm going to be, so people who donate to my Patreon at $10 a month or higher get access to kind of extra stuff, like stuff that nobody's ever seen.
The stuff that didn't so make like, it into the articles?
And yeah, or things that are really cool that are sitting on my computer that haven't been published yet. And so one of those things that I'm going to put out there is there are like hidden chapters from my Brian Eno book, which I think would be cool.
Yeah.
There's interesting pieces from it that that I didn't put out there. I mean, the funny thing was that I researched that book so hard, and that when I met Brian Eno, he was like, "Gita, your book is like the only book that I've ever thought was good about me."
Wow.
And he said that he had actually gone out and bought 4 copies of my book to give to his friends, because he's like, "Well, if you really want to know me, you should read Gita's book me." Because he's like, "She wasn't there with me in the 70s when I was making the album, she might as well have been, because everything is like, the detail is so good, you know, it's like, you know, she's like perfectly reconstructed it, you know."
That's incredible. So, what flattering praise from the man himself.
That
must have been validating. You're like, yeah, I don't know you inside and out, but I did the best I could. This was actually a really great segue. You posted on Twitter recently that someone released the book on a torrent file, so it's floating around and people can find it for free. But you are just joined the Patreon website organization where there's this concept of paying for good art. It's kind of reinstating a value. Let's talk about that a little bit. Have you had any interesting experiences of people saying, "Hey, I obtained a copy, but I want to give you something for it because of what it did for me"?
Yeah. When I found out that my book was torrented and put on every torrent site, like I wasn't super happy about that, because, you know, I.
Well, I think you said it well in an article, I think 15 questions. If people should think about the following question, what's the most respectful way to get art from this artist I love?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's hard because, being a writer is a lot like being a musician, except you can't really tour. Touring and merch, you're able to make up some of the money you're losing basically by selling your record.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a similar structure. So like, for example, with my Eno book, I get about 10% royalties. So it's like, if somebody pays $10 for it, I get $1, which is better than nothing, but it's basically like the same way it works. If you're an indie musician and somebody buys your record, you're probably getting something like 10% of a cut.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the thing with Patreon is that instead of people buying a magazine for $5 to read, like, one article by me, or buying, like, my book for $10 or $15 so that I get $1 or $1.50, it's like, why not just give Gita $5 so that she can, like, do the writing she does, rather than, like, give her, you know, support her work and then have most of it go to her publishing house or most of it go to the magazine. Yeah. You know, so I like Patreon in that it's a way to kind of directly fund the creator that you like rather than
with like a middleman, you know, or like
through a middleman.
Yeah. Have you, how, and it seems like Patreon really emphasizes building relationships with the people who are supporting you. And I know that when you launched your Patreon, you were like, everybody, you know, introduce yourself, tell me who you are and how you found me. Have you had any interesting experiences with relationships that have come from Patreon?
Yeah. Well, it's like I had come back from India and I was like painfully sick. Like, mm-hmm. And I was bedridden for 2 weeks, and I was posting to Patreon from my bed. You know, I was so sick, and you know, so amazed at how nice people were being. You know, they were sending me like healing remedies, you should take this herb or take this like kind of medicine, and I was like, wow, like. You know, these people are amazing, you know, and it's like I'm finally now feeling better after having come back from India. It's now been a month since I've been back from India. Yeah. And I'm finally like, you know, pretty much almost there. But, you know, I was just amazed at how, you know, compassionate people are, how much empathy they have, and also how many of them are artists and writers, so they really understand that life, and they understand how hard it is, and they're also like, they understand that it's not like in writing or in music or whatever, it's a process, and it's not something that, you know, you're going to have days that are horrible. You're going to have days where you're, like, so sick or, like, something's happened where it's really hard to be a writer. And then you're going to have amazing days where you get tons and tons and tons of writing done. Yeah. But that's the process. That's your, like, lifelong process of art and what you do is there's definitely going to be days when you just wish that you had like some regular office job where you knew that you didn't have to think, maybe not have to think very hard about your work, about your writing work.
Yeah.
There are times when writing is just like the most frustrating thing you can possibly imagine.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, and you kind of touched on this in that same article I read, 15 Questions. You said the creative impulse is not specific to music. All these things are interconnected. And in your book, Another Green World, you have so many comparisons to painting and film when you're talking about music. Music for you has become this access point to a web of other topics, culture, history, technology. How do you, like, consolidate the, how do you consolidate the mass of information and, like, organize it?
Yeah, I think that's a really great way of looking at it, what you just said, is that, yeah, it's folding in all these concepts and ideas from multiple media. And that's just always been the way my brain works. I was always really interested in all of these other things. You know, I loved fashion. I loved visual art. I love literature, like fiction writing. I like all these things, and they all meld together with music. And you look at somebody like David Bowie, who I think so well, like, coalesces all of those things together in such an amazing way. And maybe that's part of the reason why I'm so into Bowie and I was so crushed when he died, was because he was that, like, mixed media figure who was pulling in everything from painting and from drama and from writing and music into this one really powerful thing.
Yeah. Well, that interdisciplinary thing has been a theme in your life, but you've also been writing and researching electronic music for over 10 years. Does it ever get, I don't know, boring, I guess, is the question?
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm very, very invested in it. So I'm giving, over the next 4 weeks, 5 talks on the West Coast that are mostly about electronic music history, including a big one in San Francisco at the Exploratorium on March 17th, which is all about... It's an expanded version of a talk I gave at Light Industry in Greenpoint mm-hmm. a few years ago. And it's all about 1950s electronic music. And mm-hmm. We have these super rare films that we got from the MoMA that we're going to show on 16mm that are just incredible. Very few people have seen them, unless you were at that Light Industry gig I did a few years ago in Greenpoint.
Yeah.
But very few people in the world outside of that room at Light Industry have seen those films, and they're amazing. It's, it's so exciting to me to show people these secret things, I feel. It's here's the thing. It's not on YouTube. You know, it's this revelatory thing that you can't find.
Yeah.
And you know, that's what excites me about, you know, whether it's electronic music history or it's rare cinema or whatever, is there's still so much that we haven't seen yet.
Yeah.
So it's there's still so much we haven't heard, and there's still so much to dig up. And that's what keeps me excited, is that there's so much more that you could unearth from let's say the 40s and 50s that hasn't been extensively written about. And that I think is pretty cool.
You mentioned in a talk that was on YouTube that science fiction writers and electronic musicians socialized with one another. And you said it makes uh-huh. sense. They both were trying to invent the future. Do you think even with the mass amount of time that you spent researching and finding these secrets, that you're tip of the iceberg, or do you feel you're starting to get a grasp on the map of how it came about, I guess?
I have a much better grasp on it now than I did 15 years ago when I started, but one of the things that I love about music is that fundamentally in some way it's always a mystery, and so there's always something new to discover about it. So, you know, I feel now, you know, I've interviewed hundreds of musicians and composers over the years, and, you know, I've started to develop a picture in my head, especially after, digging into weird archives and, you know, you get all these primary documents and you put them together and you have this idea. There was a secret science fiction society in the 50s. Where people like Aldous Huxley were members, but also mm-hmm. electronic musicians were members. And it's and Ray Bradbury was in it. And then you had, you know, these kind of groundbreaking electronic musicians in it. Yes. And it kind of makes sense when you think about it. You're like, oh, okay, of course all these people were hanging out and talking to each other.
Yeah.
But it's exciting to find out about weird stuff like that. It's not something that anybody's writing about. So
definitely, when I heard you say that, I was like, oh my gosh, to be a fly on the wall in those meetings would be so amazing. You just came from an event, religious thing, but not really religious. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's. I just wrote an essay, a Patreon funded essay about my visit to the Church of John Coltrane,
mm-hmm.
And I'm not particularly religious, and I'm not Christian, but it's this church in San Francisco where they play the entirety of John Coltrane's The Love Supreme every Sunday, and it's an entire church based around John Coltrane. And I just thought the concept is so amazing and so powerful. And the church is getting evicted next week, which is incredibly sad. And San Francisco is going through a lot of difficulty right now. It's become the most expensive city in America.
Mm-hmm.
It's just crazy. And so much of what used to make San Francisco kind of a funky and interesting place is gone now. And I'm not going to be in San Francisco for very much longer. I just got back. I was in Brooklyn yesterday, actually. I just got back to California.
Yeah, we weren't quite synced up.
Yeah, we passed like ships in the night. And I miss New York a lot. And the funny thing is that New York is now cheaper than San Francisco, which is really
crazy.
Weird. For me, New York is always going to be a part of me. You know, it's I grew up in the shadow of New York City.
Yeah.
You know, I remember being a little kid in the 1980s. And, like, walking with my dad on the Lower East Side to get bagels and, going to Chinatown. And I remember what Times Square looked like in the 80s. And, you know, so for me, it's like New York was always a part of my life. And it was very, it was awesome to be back there, even if only for a few days.
Yeah.
And just the amount of stuff still happening in New York is just incredible to me.
That leads to another question I had in terms of place. How do you think, you lived in New York, you've lived in Boston, you've lived in, is it Berlin and San Francisco?
Yeah.
Among other places, I'm sure. How do you think geography has affected your writing process?
That's a really good question. So for many, many years, I had a blog. This was back when people like had blogs and maintained them, before Facebook and Twitter,
yeah,
where we're essentially giving away like all of our ideas for free, you know, and making Facebook rich or whatever. But like, you know, when everybody had a personal blog, like I had this blog called The Original Soundtrack, which I maintained and was really into, and I was living in New York City. I lived in New York for almost my whole 20s, and I was living in New York City, and I was going out, and I was seeing music almost every night, and I was writing about it, and I learned so much from the process of just going out and seeing things and then writing about it right away, and so I have just an enormous amount of writing from that period, you know, when I think about New York and how much certain venues there really had an influence on me, a lot of those venues aren't there anymore. So I'd say one of the most central venues to my mode of thinking was Tonic, which closed in 2006. And Tonic, you know, it was amazing. It was like for $5 or whatever on any night of the week, I could see like awesome experimental music. I could see there was like underground techno in the basement.
Yeah.
There was all kinds of stuff happening there. And those are really formative experiences for me, places like that. Berlin also, like there were venues there where I would see music that was just extremely formative for me. So I think part of it isn't just the geography of the city, but it's like particular venues, particular locations in those cities that were so central to my mode of thinking. And New York, just the whole geography of New York is just such, you know, it's so overpowering and so kind of overstimulating. And also, you know, you don't see that in many other cities in the United States. It's like I go to Los Angeles, I go to Portland, I go to San Francisco, and outside of like, let's say, downtown Los Angeles, where you do have something that looks maybe a little bit like New York, you know, it's just the massive scale of New York, the the skyscrapers, all that stuff. I think there's something about it that just makes you very driven and ambitious, and like you want to make a name for yourself. There's just something about the air in New York that like is really motivating. And so it was like I was in Bushwick for a little while on Friday, and I went to a gallery opening in Bushwick, and I was talking to a really old friend of mine who's like doing a million things and is like working on like three books, and I was like, yeah, like this is New York. Like I've missed this so much because in San Francisco, I'm like one of the only people here writing about music. It's like I am literally like, people meet me here and they're like, oh my God, that's so awesome that you're still in San Francisco. Like,
you're know, making it like, somehow, but it sounds like you have plans
Like, I mean, I've made it work here because my rent is really, really low. And, you know, it's like I've made it work. Like, I don't pay, you know, anywhere near what most people in San Francisco pay. That's made it doable. I mean, the weather's great here and stuff, but, you know, I still think New York, like, in terms of the United States, like, New York is, like, the city, you know, and there's always going to be something about New York. Like, as gentrified and as messed up as New York gets, it's like you can't really destroy the whole thing.
Yeah. As my roommate says, New York will break your heart, but also just love you the way that no other city will. Rumi said, there is a community of the spirit. Join it and feel the delight of walking in the noisy street and being the noise. And you talk a lot about ambient music and how it's almost like something in the background that you shouldn't be distracted by or overwhelmed by, but it's there. And it's just like influencing you. New York, I feel like, has a constant background. You almost have to feel a part of it, otherwise it can be overwhelming. Do you make music?
Do I make music?
Yeah, I'm curious. You've done so much research on music. You mentioned, I think, you played a couple instruments.
Yeah.
But yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I make music just for myself. I don't put it out there. I have, you know, I was trained in piano, so like I can play some piano, I can play some guitar, I can play a bunch of different, it's kind of like being able to speak a little bit of like four different languages, you know, like, okay, speak a little bit of French, I can speak a little bit of like Spanish, and you know, I can read music, and I occasionally will perform music, so like I did an organ concert in San Francisco where I played Brian Eno covers. And, you know, so I'll occasionally do stuff like that, but I occasionally will DJ, but I really prefer to, you know, because I just feel like we are so massively overwhelmed by a tremendous amount of music online. Like, there's so much stuff to listen to. There are so many podcasts. There's so much stuff that I'm like, I feel like instead of adding more to that, in terms of making my own music or my own DJ sets, that maybe what I could do is write about music to help people sort through it all, you know, because there's just so much to hear that I feel like I'm maybe better utilized as a person who's going to write like a long text that will like illuminate some little corner of the musical landscape.
Well, this is something you've talked about, just about the changes in technology have made it possible for anyone who wants to create music. So it leads to a lot of, I mean, you can find anything you're looking for or create it yourself, you know, but there's definitely something to be said for, talent and the ability to see things differently, which Brian Eno epitomizes. I'm thinking about his strange approach and specifically the oblique strategy cards, which you have a deck of, and I'm kind of jealous after hearing about him. Is that something you've incorporated into your own creative processes?
Yeah, absolutely. you know, the Oblique Strategies cards are sitting right in front of me right now when I get stuck. Yeah, you can buy them. I think there's so many different editions of them. So if you have a first edition, which was from 1975, those decks are worth like over $1,000, I think.
Uh-huh. And you got gifted one, right?
Yeah. The most recent deck, so I have one of the newer decks. The newer decks you can get for like $50. Or, you know, for free, you can just, I think there's an iPhone app. It's not quite the same, but, you know.
Yeah, you do what you can.
And so the cards are great because, you know, when I get stuck and I'll be thinking about something, and I often get stuck. I mean, I think every creative person gets stuck a lot of the time, and there's so many other stresses in life, and there's so many things in your way and obstacles and all these things. And, you know, I'll pick up a card and it'll say something like, "What would your best friend do?" And I'll think about it for a while, and then I'll just go do that thing. You know, it's like, nice. I wrote in the introduction to my Eno book that was the way that's the way I wrote that book.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's good. It's good to shake up, you know,
yeah,
to kind of shake up your thinking a little bit. I wrote this for this magazine in Brooklyn called Cabinet, which you probably know.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a big essay for them about the Oblique Strategies cards, and not just the Oblique Strategies, but all of these different kinds of cards that emerged, a lot of them in the 1960s.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people were using different kinds of cards to come up with ideas, like the Fluxus movement. They had a whole series of different card decks. You know, Marshall McLuhan had a card deck in the late 60s called the Distant Early Warning Card.
Nothing to do. Well, I feel like as a creative, a lot of times when you are feeling stuck, it's because I think it's an issue of control. And so I think these cards introduce this degree of entropy of like just play, just have fun, like stop taking it so seriously and stop getting frustrated when it's not coming out exactly as you envision it, because it might be coming out as something that's better than what you envisioned, potentially.
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of times when you're writing, the first couple drafts are going to be like absolute crap.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, it's a constant process of refining and writing drafts. Like, if you start out by, like, you know, it's like at this point I've written, I think, over 1,000 articles. Like, not a lot of the stuff I've written isn't even listed on my website.
Yeah, and that's a pretty big list just there.
Yeah. And it's like, if I went into it every day thinking, oh, this has to be, like, my best piece ever, you know, you'd never get anything done. You know, you have to just, like, throw stuff at the wall and hope something's going to stick. That's the case whether you're a painter, you're a musician, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's like when you're a musician and you're just playing something, you're like, well, this isn't going anywhere. And then, you know, over the course of several iterations, maybe you'll get something out there, or just a lot of jamming, you're going to come up, ideas are just going to emerge. Mm-hmm. And they're not going to come from a top-down process where, like you said, it's control, where you're dictating everything, but it's going to come from more of an organic, bottom-up kind of process where these ideas are like percolating maybe in your subconscious mind, and then they kind of take root. I mean, that's what I find really exciting and interesting. It's like when I was writing that piece about Coltrane a few days ago, I kind of didn't know where the piece was going to lead.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, you know, and then I was thinking suddenly about what Eno said about control versus surrender and how much it fit in with everything I was experiencing. You know, it's just these things that there's all these pieces in your brain and you forget how they interlock with each other sometimes. And sometimes it's just sitting there at your computer and writing where puzzle pieces in your head start to fit together and you start connecting ideas together in a way that you know, you might not have thought about if you were just really kind of formally dictating it or mapping it out in your head, you know?
Yeah.
So there has to be an element of, like, some of my favorite writers are more stream of consciousness or... they pluck kind of unlikely connections.
Yeah, and that makes you see things differently. We're getting close to the end of the show, and I do want to do a say a quick plug. Reading your article about Bowie really struck me in a way that a lot of other articles about him haven't, and I think it's because you did what you do, which is, you know, instead of echoing what's out there, you kind of brought out your own idea. But there's one part... you said Bowie integrates so well into your life that he becomes a part of the furniture of the air. And then you go on to say Bowie's mythology was our reality, our history, a performance with no beginning or end, threaded so subtly into our lives that it has become a part of us. So if you haven't read, you know, listeners, if you haven't read the article, it's really beautiful. I like to end my shows with a rapid fire, something I took from Tim Ferriss's podcast. And so I have a series of questions, and so the answer can be I don't know. The answer might be the whole rest of the show. We'll just see what happens. Does that sound okay?
Uh-huh.
Great. What book have you not gotten around to reading?
Oh, man. there's a... So I am like a very avid collector of books, and there are a bunch of books sitting in front of me that I would want to dig into next. So there's a technical book called Designing Sound on the History of Sound Design that I am looking at right now. There is a book about acoustics and architecture called Spaces Speak, Are You Listening?
Uh-huh.
That's next on my list. Lots of books about music, architecture, and sound design.
Nice. Is there a book or any books that you remember your parents reading to you?
Oh, man. Not that I can recall, really.
Okay. And do you have any rituals or routines that are related to your writing?
Rituals or routines?
Yeah.
Yeah. When I'm really homing in on a piece of writing, I have this really cheap $100 laptop that is really crappy, and like the only thing you can do on it is write in plain text. And it's like really hard to browse the internet. It's really hard to do anything except just write. And so I use this really like old crappy laptop to do my writing on. Because I know I'll just be writing. So that's certainly one ritual. And then the other one is really, you know, to take care of yourself, like of your own body. So stuff like yoga can really help, you know, eating well, stuff like that, because, riding your bicycle. A lot of like ideas I came up with the Eno book were made while riding a bicycle.
That's wonderful.
Physical activity is really important when you're a writer.
What a great answer. Thank you. I feel like a lot of people have a book they read when they were transitioning into puberty that kind of changed them. Is there a book that comes to mind for you, or like a comfort food reading that you go back to?
No, wow. I read tons and tons of books. Like, I was always, like, a big bookworm. Like, I was always reading a lot of books. When I was a teenager or, you know, preteen, I read a lot more fiction then. And, you know, I would have to say, actually, that me and my best friend at the time, we subscribed to British Music Magazine. And we, you know, it was before the World Wide Web, and we got every issue like 2 months late. And then, you know, we would read about these bands like My Bloody Valentine.
Yeah.
You know, it's like 1990 or whatever. And we'd be like, who are these bands? You know, so I think it was at that time when I was a preteen, it was less about particular works of literature, and it was more about the music press. It was reading Melody Maker shipped 2 months late from, you know, Britain, and like reading about all of these things that I didn't really have access to in suburban New Jersey.
Yeah, nice.
So that definitely had an impact on me. It was like these, you know, before the internet, you know, it was like these amazing dispatches from another world where, you know, you would read the review and then you'd be like, try to figure out what my Bloody Valentine's
trying to find them,
or whatever sounded like based on like the little description. And you're like, wow, they sound really cool. you know, or whatever band it was, or, you know, reading about British rave culture or whatever it was, and just being like, man, I wish I was at those parties. Like, so, you know, I think when I was 12 or 13, you know, I was reading stuff like that. And also a formative record store called the Princeton Record Exchange. So I went to the same high school as James Murphy from LCD Sound System, and a lot of other musicians went to my high school as well, and we all shopped at that record store. We all shopped at the Princeton Record Exchange, which is somehow still there.
That's amazing.
And that was like super formative for me, that record store.
What is the best writing advice you've been given?
I think from my friend Neil Gaiman, who has an amazing work ethic. You know, he's always putting words down on the page, and he would show me his notebook. So he writes in longhand, like with a black fountain pen, in like these hardback, like beautiful notebooks with like cream paper. And it really inspired me to see how he writes his books in like, and how he writes them with a pen and a notebook. And how he really just, you know, when he's writing, he'll like go into his cabin and he won't come out. You know, it's like he's really devoted to that process of writing, and it's inspiring to see other writers and to see their process and to see how they work.
Nice. And this might be a long question. What writers have most influenced you? Neil Gaiman sounds like has been a pretty heavy influence. Is there other writers that have influenced you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, David Toop, I would say, is one of my biggest kind of inspirations. He's a music writer in England, and I've been reading his writing for more than 20 years. I mean, he's incredible thinker and writer on music. Another person is Mark Sinker, another British writer. A lot of writers from England, I've noticed.
Yeah.
I have a lot of kindred spirits in England. And so a lot of my favorite writers are from there, who write about music. And then I have some very good friends and colleagues here in the States, too, who write about music, who inspire me. My friend Michelangelo Matos, who up until very recently lived in Bed-Stuy, and he just, now he's in Minneapolis. He's a great writer with an incredible work ethic on music, especially on dance music. There's so many people who have really inspired me, and so many of them are my good friends. And, you know, these days it's like we're all so spread out around the world that the only way we really, like, talk to each other is on stuff like Twitter. None of us are physically in the same location. So it makes it hard sometimes because, you know, there isn't that, like, physical community as much anymore, I feel, as there used to be. It's a lot of it plays out on social media.
Yeah, it's something I've kind of noticed, and I just joined Twitter, and it's like building relationships with people is an interesting process, but it almost seems like the dynamics of relationships are changing based on social media. Well, it doesn't seem like it, they are. This is our show. Thank you so much for talking to us and making time in your schedule and your day. And
yeah, thanks for having me.
It was wonderful meeting you and talking to you. So
yeah. Hope to see you when I'm next in New York.
Yeah, I would love that. Great. Have a lovely day.
You too.
Bye.
All right. Bye.
So that was Geeta Dayal. And so amazing to have her join us today. So Empty Orchestra will be next, exploring the dynamic relationship between song and singer in the context of karaoke with Angelica and Amanda. You've been listening to Ink and Worm, All Things Reading and Writing. I'm on all the socials, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. I have a website. I'm on Stitcher, iTunes. So find me, reach out to me, tell me what you think, what you like, what you don't like. And I will leave you with a word, take it or leave it. Solficism.